Hello, I'm Keith Wallman, the online publisher for Cell and the Cell Press family of journals. Welcome to the Cell Podcast. In our program today, we'll be talking with Dr. Gökhan Hotamishlagil about a new lipid hormone produced by fat that may help to keep you thin. And then we will hear from Dr. Ralf Steinmann, who discovered dendritic cells 3 decades ago, about using these immune cells to make better vaccines. We will also learn from Dr. Elizabeth Phelps about regions of the human brain that control responses to fearful memories and the implications for treating post-traumatic stress disorder. And stay tuned for a roundup of some of the exciting research advances recently published in Cell and the Cell Press family of journals. In our first interview, Dr. Emily Marcus, the editor of Cell, speaks with Dr. Gökhan Hotamishlagil of the Harvard School of Public Health about his new study in the September 19th issue of Cell. This study identifies a lipid hormone, or lipokine, produced by fat cells in mice that protects them from the damaging effects of a high-fat diet. Here now is Emily Marcus talking with Dr. Hotamishlagil about this exciting research and its implications for treating metabolic diseases, including obesity and type 2 diabetes.
The regulation of fat metabolism is an important contributor to insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. For example, it is well accepted that elevations in circulating free fatty acids are associated with peripheral insulin resistance. Fatty acid binding proteins, or FABPs, are lipid chaperones that dictate the partitioning of lipids within cells. Somewhat paradoxically, however, mice deficient in the FABPs normally present in adipose tissue, AP2 and MAL1, while exhibiting elevated free fatty acid levels, also have improved insulin sensitivity and are resistant to metabolic diseases such as atherosclerosis, type 2 diabetes, and obesity. In a paper published in this week's issue of Cell, Gökhan Hotamishlagil and colleagues at the Harvard School of Public Health provide new insight into this paradox by identifying a lipid hormone-like signal, palmitoate, which is released from the adipose tissue of these mice and acts systemically to protect the mice from the deleterious effects of a high-fat diet. This new concept of intertissue communication via a protective or beneficial adipocyte-derived lipid signal, which the authors refer to as a lipokine, could have implications for the treatment of metabolic diseases in humans. Dr. Hotamishlagil, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, my pleasure.
Your findings that adipose tissue releases the lipid signal palmitoate, which in turn affects systemic metabolism, were quite unexpected. Could you tell us a bit about what we knew in general terms about adipose tissue and its role in metabolism prior to your findings, and why your results are therefore so exciting?
Yeah, so I think as a general kind of belief, both among scientists and otherwise, is that, you know, fat is bad. And the more you have it, the worse it is. And there, of course, fat is referring to, I mean, several different things, one being adipose tissue. So if you accumulate more of the tissue which accommodates fat, you become obese. And we know that when you become obese, you are at risk for many other diseases such as diabetes, heart disease, asthma, cancers, and many more. So this actually, maybe in the past decade, people realized, including our group, that adipose tissue actually is not just sitting there accumulating fat, but producing signals that changes the behavior of other organs. And most of this is by traditional hormones. And within the context of obesity, again, most people think that the more fat you have in your blood, the worse it is. And so whether it is cholesterol or triglycerides or fatty acids. And I think in more cases than not, this is certainly true. But when it comes to fatty acids, I think this kind of fat is a mixture of hundreds, if not thousands, of different molecules. So it's kind of a big soup of things. Kind of hypothesis which led to discovery of this concept and the molecule is that within this big soup of things, there might be good things and bad things. So we may not necessarily, based on its amount, predict that this fat will be good or will be bad. Or by reducing all of fatty acids, we may actually lose some good signals there as well.
One of the impressive accomplishments of your study was performing a high-resolution lipidomics analysis, which allowed for quantification of over 400 lipid species in multiple tissues from wild-type and FABP-deficient mice. Could you tell us about your rationale for performing these experiments and what you were expecting to uncover?
Yeah, so as you say in the beginning, we needed somewhere to start in tackling these lipids and consider the fact that there might be conditions where you have high lipids but good outcomes. And the mouse model we used was a kind of striking example of that. There was a high amount of lipids in the blood and still very good outcomes. The interesting thing there was the genes that we modified to produce that mouse model, which, by the way, was an extraordinarily healthy animal, were restricted to adipose tissue. So we know that we were changing something in adipose tissue, yet seeing the impact of this change elsewhere in the body, such as liver and muscle. So the obvious hypothesis was that because of the changes that we introduced, there was a hormone produced from fat going to liver and muscle and communicating signals between these organs. And when we say hormone, of course, everyone, including us, thinks about peptides and proteins. And so did we. And we spent many years searching for a protein hormone and found absolutely nothing. So only then we started considering that this actually may not be a protein after all, and maybe a lipid, which the protein that we modified targeted in the first place. So then actually we used the technique called lipomics to study all identifiable lipids in order to identify a lipid activity within that big soup of things. So lipomics is similar to, you know, what people did to examine genes by genomics or proteins by proteomics. So in this case, we looked at all identifiable lipids. And for this, we also enjoyed a collaboration between our group and Michelle Waist and Steve Watkins in lipomics.
By comparing the lipid profiles of adipose tissue in wild-type and knockout mice, you demonstrate that a high-fat diet reduces the level of pimidylate in wild-type mice, but fails to cause a similar reduction in adipose tissue from the knockouts.
Mm-hmm.
From this, one can build a model that a high-fat diet in wild-type mice triggers some sort of feedback loop that shuts down de novo production of pimidylate, and that this feedback loop is abrogated in the knockouts. Does this model capture your current thinking, and if so, what might it say about the relationship between dietary fat intake and de novo lipogenesis?
Yeah, so this is, I think, one of the, at least to me, one of the most exciting aspects of our work is that, so the molecule we identified, I mean, itself acts as a hormone, and we were able to associate really good hormonal activities with this on liver and muscle, stimulating, you know, glucose uptake and disposal in the muscle and control of lipid synthesis in the liver. However, in addition to that, this actually discovery taught us something very important about a process called de novo lipogenesis. So this is, I think in the simplest term, is production of your own fat without the outside influence of diet. So I think when adipose tissue is protected from the dietary influence and forced to produce its own lipids through this process, I think that turns out to produce the best fat and healthiest form of fat in order to maintain a good metabolic balance. So the best is what you make yourself in fat tissue, not what you get out of the diet. So if we can find ways to stimulate fat tissue to work a little bit more and make its own fat rather than accumulating everything coming through the diet and from other sources, that will be the best kind. So it's kind of like eating a homemade meal. It always tastes better than what you eat elsewhere. And so this will be, for example, I think a really important future opening for considering ways to trigger, tackle the fat tissue a little bit so it starts producing more of its own good fat. And so the second possibility, of course, is we know that palmitoylate, or this particular lipid that we identified and called a lipokine in the study, itself, irrespective of what happens in the fat tissue, could still be a good molecule to have around. And if that is the case, we don't know if that is the case. Certainly in experimental models, if we deliver this lipid in isolation to an animal, this lipid acts to stimulate insulin action in the liver and in the muscle. So it kind of acts like insulin. So it is possible that even without tackling adipose tissue, by just administering this lipid or giving it through a dietary supplement, you can still get beneficial effects. But that, of course, remains to be seen, because it may have to go hand-in-hand with what happens in adipose tissue. So it may or may not be so effective in isolation. However, in the mice, at least, we know that it is a pretty active molecule.
And then finally, the last question, which is a bit more speculative, probably. Do you anticipate that other lipokines have yet to be identified? As the first such lipokine, palmitoylate appears to have a beneficial or protective systemic effect, but do you envision that there may also be lipokines with detrimental systemic effects that could be a target for therapy?
Yes, absolutely. So I think as a first study, we just happened to use a model which will favor identification of a beneficial lipokine. But just like in peptide mediators secreted from adipose tissue and possibly other cell types, yes, there will be other lipokines with a variety of different activities, some good, some bad, some acting on perhaps immune cells, some acting on the central nervous system, and with the negative and positive effects, absolutely. So this is, I think, just the first example of this class of bioactive molecules.
Okay, well, thank you for speaking with us today, and again, congratulations on a very nice story.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Emily. To discover more about this study, visit the Cell website at www.cell.com. And now we will hear from scientific editor Dr. Charles Yokoyama with a special announcement from Neuron.
On behalf of Neuron and Cell Press, I'm pleased to announce a one-day meeting to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Neuron. The meeting will be held on November 14th as a satellite to the Society for Neuroscience Conference in Washington, D.C. The speakers will include distinguished scientists spanning the breadth of neuroscience, from molecular to systems approaches, including Corey Bargman, Josh Sains, Mike Greenberg, Tobias Bonhoeffer, Li-Wei Tsai, Eric Nessler, Bob Desimone, Roger Nicol, and Yuri Buzhaki. Registration for the meeting will begin on September 15th via the Neuron website. Get an early start to the Society for Neuroscience Conference and hear exciting new perspectives on the past, present, and future of neuroscience as we celebrate 20 years of Neuron with this one-day meeting on November 14th. On a different but just as exciting note, Neuron is pleased to announce an upcoming special reviews issue on the topic of calcium signaling at the synapse. Calcium ions are of fundamental importance to neurons and glia of the central nervous system, but only with sophisticated new techniques have scientists begun to unravel molecular and physiological cascades initiated by calcium ions. We have invited prominent researchers working on calcium signaling in brain synapses to offer their perspectives in a series of review articles. Look for this special reviews issue on September 25th.
Dendritic cells are the commanders-in-chief of the immune system, mobilizing T and B cells to fight infection. Given their talents, dendritic cells may be of value for developing new immunotherapies for treating cancer and other diseases. These enigmatic cells are the subject of a special section in the September issue of Immunity. Here to tell us more is the editor of Immunity, Dr. Peter Lee, in conversation with Dr. Ralph Steinman, the immunologist who discovered dendritic cells 35 years ago.
The September issue of Immunity presents six exciting review articles on our latest understanding of dendritic cells, perhaps one of the most fascinating cells of the immune system. Dendritic cells are central to immune responses. This is because they link the sensing of antigens to the adaptive responses that involve T and B cells. These T and B cells are in turn able to produce antibodies and destroy infected cells or tumor cells. It follows then that dendritic cells would be an excellent target for immunotherapies. However, to design a good vaccine based on these cells, we must first understand how they behave in the body, such as how they migrate to sites of immune responses, how they present antigens to T cells, and how the different subsets respond during an immune challenge. To tell us more about the importance of these cells, we are honored to have on the line with us today the founding father of the dendritic cell field, Dr. Ralph Steinman from the Rockefeller University. Welcome, Dr. Steinman, and thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Good to be here.
Dr. Steinman, perhaps you could start off by explaining some of the features that make dendritic cells a good target for vaccine development.
Okay, I think we can divide it up into four features, or at least I find it easiest to do it that way. The first feature is the way dendritic cells are located in the body. So they're naturally located at places that infections enter the body, and then they travel with the information they pick up from the infection to the immune organs to initiate and control immunity. So when one injects a vaccine, there's really a good opportunity that that vaccine can gain access to the dendritic cells and be taken to the right place to control immunity. The second thing is that dendritic cells are very good antigen-capturing and antigen-processing cells. So that means that they're able to take up the antigen and convert it typically into peptides that are then presented to the immune system, particularly T cells. So this means that when you inject a vaccine, if it's picked up by the dendritic cells, there's a good chance that it'll be processed appropriately to be recognized by T cells. The third thing is that dendritic cells are said to undergo differentiation process that's called maturation. This means that the dendritic cell changes extensively upon receiving stimuli from the environment. And these stimuli can be in the form of microbial products or cytokines or interactions with other innate lymphocytes, for example. So what this does is it allows the dendritic cell to tailor the immune response to the T cell that's responding to the presented antigen. It allows the T cell to undergo a response that's appropriate to the challenge or environmental situation at hand. So in the vaccine context, if we can figure out what one needs to the type of T cell one needs to defend against the virus, we ought to be able to teach the dendritic cell how to mimic that when it picks up the vaccine. And then the fourth feature of dendritic cells is that they are comprised of subsets. And these subsets are specialized to take up different antigens or to respond differently to environmental cues, even to be located differently in the body. So by knowing the properties of these subsets, one can, again, gain more control over the type of an immune response that a vaccine will elicit and the efficacy of that immune response.
They certainly sound promising. So what are some of the potential hurdles to making an effective dendritic cell-based vaccine?
You mentioned about hurdles, and there are hurdles at each of these steps. So in terms of location, where the dendritic cells are most abundant is in the lymphoid tissue. So the trick we have to learn in vaccine science is to mobilize the largest number of dendritic cells that are capturing the vaccine. And one way to do that I cited in the perspective article was to actually teach the vaccine to target or to be delivered to the dendritic cell. And in this way, many more dendritic cells pick up the vaccine. In terms of the antigen capture process itself, this too has a hurdle in that if the dendritic cell doesn't recognize the vaccine by a specific receptor, then the uptake process isn't really efficient. So if one can design vaccines that are recognized by the appropriate receptors on dendritic cells, they will become much more efficient. The third thing in terms of dendritic cell maturation is that there are obviously many types of maturation and differentiation that the dendritic cells can undergo. They can even learn how to silence or tolerize the immune system. So one has to work out the defined stimuli that one would administer with vaccines to control the maturation or differentiation of the dendritic cell to give you the immune response that's appropriate to the disease you're trying to vaccinate against. And then in terms of dendritic cell subsets, here I think one of the main hurdles is to link the data that are coming out from mice with those that are in humans. And there's one case where we have data in humans on subsets, particularly in the skin, where we don't have as good data, I think, in the mouse yet. So trying to make the link between the experimental animal and the human is actually one of the hurdles in vaccine research.
So what are some of the most promising advances in dendritic cell vaccine research? Is it advances in dendritic cell manipulation, such as targeting of antigens to CD205? Or is it something that is coming from another branch of immunology research that will help target the immune system on multiple fronts?
Yeah, I think the field of immunology is really providing multiple fronts that can be exploited in vaccine design and vaccine development. You began with one that we're working on, which is to make sure that a vaccine, particularly if you're using proteins as vaccines, to make sure they get taken up by the dendritic cell. And we're doing this by introducing the protein into monoclonal antibodies that react with receptors on dendritic cells. So when you inject the monoclonal antibody, you deliver very efficiently the vaccine protein to the dendritic cell. But then there's the field of pattern recognition receptors, the receptors that the body uses to recognize microbial and products and even many endogenous substances. And by defining these pattern recognition receptors and what they do in the innate immune response, one is really reaping a harvest of potential compounds that could be used to trigger the immune system and particularly the dendritic cells into action. Another area that's moving very beautifully in immunology is to define the different types of T cells and what their properties are. So particularly in the case of CD4 helper cells, there are many forms, Th1, Th2, Th17, and certainly different regulatory cells that are being defined and give us ways to monitor the quality of the response to a vaccine that we never had before. And then finally, there's just the whole field of immune monitoring, which is, I think, a really important part of vaccine science. That is, how do you measure what the immune system is doing? So the field of genomics, for example, particularly the use of gene arrays, is really an exciting way to monitor what's going on in different cell types, including humans. In other words, one can inject a vaccine and look what's happening in the peripheral blood to start to figure out what's really going on at the molecular level when we're trying to develop a vaccine. And I think it's going to change vaccine biology from what many consider to be an empirical activity to a really exciting science.
Well, thank you so much for your wonderful insights and your outstanding contribution to immunology and vaccinology.
Thank you, Peter, and thanks for leading a great journal in immunology.
Thank you, Peter. Check out the September issue of Immunity and the special section on dendritic cells at www.immunity.com. Now it's over to Dr. Orla Smith, editor of Cell's Leading Edge, for news about recent research highlights published in Cell Press journals.
Mitochondria are the powerhouses that generate energy for cells, and they are particularly important for tissues that guzzle energy, such as muscle, liver, brain, and retina. Mitochondria have their own DNA that is separate from nuclear DNA, and mutations in mitochondrial genes lead to a wide variety of diseases. One mitochondrial disease that may be responsible for up to 2% of cases of blindness in people under 65 is Leber hereditary optic neuropathy. This disease is caused by mutations in mitochondrial genes such as ATP6, ND1, and ND4, which encode proteins that form respiratory complex 1 of the mitochondrion. These mutations result in death of retinal ganglion cells, atrophy of the optic nerve, and vision loss. There is much interest in using a gene therapy strategy called allotropic expression to treat this disease. In this approach, a normal form of the mutated mitochondrial gene is expressed in the nucleus, leading to production of a functional protein that then moves to the mitochondria to carry out its task. Reporting in the September issue of the American Journal of Human Genetics, Dr. Marisol Corral-Dobrinsky and her team at the Université Pierre-Emery Curie in Paris test this gene therapy approach in a rat model of Leber hereditary optic neuropathy. They show that allotropic expression of the normal form of the human ND4 gene in rats that carry a mutant form of this gene prevents loss of retinal ganglion cells and prevents impaired vision. Here is Dr. Karel Dobrinsky to tell us more.
We decide to produce a model ourselves. We create the model, and for this we inject eye of animals with a mutant version of the ND4 gene, and indeed we get something that is very similar to what happened in patients. That means that the retinal ganglion cells die, and then the visual function is impaired. Then we decide, using our method, to try to prevent that in this animal model. And then we succeed to prevent retinal ganglion cells' death and also to preserve vision function in these animals.
And what will be the next step for Dr. Karel Dobrinsky and her team?
We inject in the eye a transgene that is only expressed for 2 or 3 months. We are going to do so with a new vector that will allow us a long-lasting expression. And then we'll try to check either in animals, in rats and mice, that is safe for a long time, and also in monkeys, because the retina of monkeys are very similar to human retina. And then if the treatment is safe and there is no problem in the retina and vision function during the time, then it will be good to go ahead and ask for the authorization to make clinical trials in humans.
And from balancing the energy needs of cells to balancing the flux of salt and water across cell membranes, the job of chloride channels. One group of these channels, calcium-activated chloride channels, have been particularly difficult to identify. These channels are important for secretion of fluids across airway epithelia, for smooth muscle contraction, and for excitation of neurons and cardiac muscle. They are also important for fertilization, as they ensure that only one sperm fertilizes an oocyte. It is this function that enabled Lily Jan and her team at the University of California, San Francisco, to pinpoint the calcium-activated chloride channel of frog oocytes. Both Dr. Jan's team, reporting in the September 19th issue of Cell, and the group of Yang et al., working in mouse and reporting in Nature, now identify the long-sought calcium-activated chloride channel as TMEM16A, a highly conserved transmembrane protein of unknown function. Here is Dr. Jan to explain her unique expression cloning system in oocytes of the axolotl that enabled her to identify the calcium-activated chloride channel of the frog.
The function of this channel in the Xenopus oocyte is to prevent polyspermia. So when the first sperm comes to the egg, it will activate the calcium-activated chloride channel. But then some amphibia, some of the salamander species are normally physiologically polyspermic, so they actually allow more than one sperm enter the egg. And so then we thought maybe some of those species may not have this channel in the oocyte, and that turned out to be the case for axolotl.
Mutations in chloride channels have been linked to cystic fibrosis and asthma in humans. So will identification of the calcium-activated chloride channel provide potential new treatments for these diseases? Dr. Jan.
For the airway epithelia, the apical membrane that faces the lumen, the airway, contains two different kinds of chloride channels. One is the cystic fibrosis, the CFTR chloride channel, and the other one is the calcium-activated chloride channel. And that was the reason for the idea that perhaps increasing the remaining chloride channel, the calcium-activated chloride channel activity, will help compensate for the problems with not having the CFTR in the apical membrane. And for asthma or other chronic airway disease, bronchitis, it's a similar situation that it's the control of the flow of salt and water, basically, to maintain the surface liquid to be exactly the right height for the cilia to move properly. And that could be regulated by this channel. And up to this point, without knowing the channel identity, the approach used is to regulate the receptor that's upstream of the channel. But now it may be also possible to look for channel modulators using the clone channel in expression systems to screen for small molecules.
A cell that rivals the calcium-activated chloride channel when it comes to mystery is the elusive mesenchymal stem cell. A tour de force study appearing in the September issue of Cell Stem Cell by Bruno Peo and his colleagues at the University of Pittsburgh now unmasks the true identity of the mesenchymal stem cell. These researchers directly compared the surface marker signatures and differentiation potential of perivascular cells, or pericytes, which are wrapped around the blood vessels of all tissues, with what we know about mesenchymal stem cells. Dr. Peo's team reveals that pericytes purified from a wide range of human, fetal, and adult organs are equally adept at becoming muscle, bone, cartilage, and fat tissue when cultured in vitro. This differentiation potential is also the hallmark of the mysterious mesenchymal stem cell, raising the question of whether pericytes and mesenchymal stem cells are in fact one and the same. To answer this question, here is Dr. Peo.
When you culture purified pericytes from either human tissue, you get a population of cells which morphologically, antigenically, and in terms especially of developmental potential, are absolutely indistinguishable from mesenchymal stem cells. So they express the same markers, they have the same morphology, they migrate actively, they can be cultured for weeks and months. We have cultured these cells up to 5 months with no sign of senescence. And they can differentiate readily into muscle, into cartilage, into bone, into adipocytes, fat tissues. So our conclusion is that, in fact, these elusive mesenchymal stem cells are, in fact, derived from these perivascular cells.
And now, a special announcement from Cell Press.
Introducing the new Cell.com. In early October, be sure to look again at Cell.com and discover its all-new look. The site has been completely redesigned from the ground up. Its technology infrastructure upgrade gives you a more stable and agile online platform. The new Cell.com now integrates the 14 Trends Reviews titles and 13 primary research journals published by Cell Press, offering you one of the most comprehensive portfolios of high-quality, dynamic, multidisciplinary life science research. Utilize the improved, more robust search function, which provides you greater flexibility, resulting in more relevant search findings and quicker access to content. Take full advantage of video, animations, and sound files accompanying articles. Easily navigate the homepage, article pages, or archive, as each has been carefully thought out for optimal information organization. Plus, Cell.com will continue to offer innovative features such as Snapshot and Paperclips. Look again at the new Cell.com in early October and discover more.
And finally, let's join scientific editor Dr. Chris Dixon to learn more about a fascinating imaging study in humans published in the September 11th issue of Neuron. This study reveals regions of the human brain that are able to control responses to fearful memories. Here now is Chris Dixon in conversation with lead author of the study, Dr. Elizabeth Phelps of New York University.
Remembering fearful or dangerous situations protects us from repeating the same mistakes again. As the saying goes, once bitten, twice shy. But healthy behavior also requires that we adapt our emotional responses as situations change. Humans have the ability to control and eliminate negative emotional responses either naturally through extinction or consciously using cognitive strategies. In the September 11th issue of Neuron, Elizabeth Phelps, Maurizio Delgado, and colleagues at New York University report on their analyses of brain activation in humans performing a cognitive regulation task, and contrast these responses to the neural circuitry responsible for extinction. Using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, which allows real-time visualization of brain responses. The researchers assessed brain activity in the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, regions involved in executive control and emotional regulation, respectively. Dr. Phelps now joins us to talk about this exciting research and its implications. Hello, Dr. Phelps.
Hi.
Dr. Phelps, can you tell us what was previously known about the brain mechanisms controlling extinction and cognitive emotional regulation?
So we know quite a bit about extinction from studies in humans and other species. And what we know is that the amygdala, this region that is important in representing learned fear, has a connection with the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And through the interconnections between these two regions, they work together when we extinguish fear. The ventromedial prefrontal cortex seems to retain that learning and inhibit the amygdala response, thus inhibiting the expression of fear. In humans, we can diminish fears through extinction, but we can also use our minds. We can think about things differently. We can be in a fearful situation, but focus on other aspects of the situation, or perhaps, calm ourselves down by telling ourselves that this is not really as fearful as it seems. We can reinterpret the situation at hand to help diminish our fear response. And this is called cognitive emotion regulation. And what we know is that these parts of the brain that we think are responsible for manipulating information online, particularly the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, seems to be more active when you're now diminishing your fear through using a cognitive technique by reinterpreting the stimulus. This dorsolateral prefrontal cortex region doesn't have direct projections to the amygdala. It does project to, however, more medial and ventral regions of the prefrontal cortex, which also project to the amygdala.
So you've mentioned roles to the amygdala, the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex in these two fear regulation processes.
Mm-hmm.
How did you assess similarities and differences in the neural circuitry controlling extinction and conscious emotional regulation?
What we were interested in was the relationship between these two types of learning. What's similar and what's different between emotion regulation and extinction? We have these two techniques for controlling fears. They both, when you've learned to successfully control a fear, they both show diminished activity in the amygdala. We had the thought that perhaps what's happening is that when you use these conscious strategies, given that these regions don't project to the amygdala directly, but rather to regions such as the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which do project to the amygdala directly, that maybe what's happening in these conscious strategies is we're actually now using our minds to co-opt the mechanisms of extinction to diminish fear. So at least part of the circuitry between extinction and emotion regulation is overlapping. So we used a conditioned fear paradigm, and we asked subjects to when they saw a square of a particular color that predicted they may or may not get a shock, on some of the trials, to instead of focusing on the fact that this square predicted they may or may not get a shock, to instead think about an image from nature that was calming from them that color reminded them of. So for instance, if you saw a blue square, you might imagine the ocean. Or if you saw a yellow square, you might imagine a field of daisies. So they practiced being able to use these strategies in advance, much like you would, say, if you went to a clinic and had cognitive behavioral therapy and were trying to come up with strategies next time you're in an anxiety-provoking situation. We saw a decreased response in the amygdala. We saw an increased response in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is, again, consistent with other studies of emotion regulations, and these other studies have used much more complex stimuli. And we also saw a pattern in the ventral medial prefrontal cortex of response that looked very much like what we'd seen previously in extinction learning. That is, we saw increases in responses in this region when subjects were now controlling their fear through a cognitive strategy. That's exactly the same pattern that we see when subjects control their fear through extinction. So at the level of the ventral medial prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, the responses look exactly the same in extinction and emotion regulation.
As you've pointed out, we know quite a bit about extinction mechanisms from studies in animals.
Mm-hmm.
How do your current findings link to that research?
Well, I think the strength of showing that sort of at least part of the circuitry is overlapping between emotion regulation and extinction is that we can know quite a bit more about the neurochemistry, the detailed neurocircuitry that is underlying extinction learning because we can study these things in non-humans. So this brings to the study of emotion regulation at least some ideas about that circuitry. One of the primary reasons we're interested in how we control fear is because there are many situations where fear is not adaptive, such as in anxiety disorders.
And speaking of anxiety disorders, we're hearing a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder in the news. As improperly managed stressful situations have a negative impact on human health, what are the broader implications of your findings for developing therapies for treating anxiety disorders?
So in the clinic, people have used bolt exposure therapy, which is essentially a model of extinction, where now you force somebody, say, with a phobia to confront the thing they're afraid of with no aversive consequences, and eventually they learn to extinguish their fear response. So individuals have used exposure therapy in the clinic already as one way to treat anxiety disorders. At the same time, cognitive behavioral therapy is essentially a model of emotion regulation. In that case, people are brought into the clinic and they're actually taught to interpret things differently, to imagine in advance going through a circumstance that may be fearful and coming up with alternative strategies to make it less fearful. And what this research is telling us by linking together the circuitry of extinction and emotion regulation is that really, for at least a part of the circuitry, the same mechanisms are involved. So, for instance, we now have some interesting drugs that are being developed that actually can enhance extinction. Our data might suggest that when you use a cognitive behavioral technique with D-cycloserine, you may see a similar effect. Okay, so now we can take the data from extinction where we know something about the neurochemistry, which is being used in the development of pharmacological treatments for anxiety disorders, and we can say that at least, you know, there's some evidence that maybe those same type of treatments can interact with cognitive behavioral therapy in the same way.
This is really exciting work, Dr. Phelps. Thanks for discussing it with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Check out this study in the September 11th issue of Neuron at www.neuron.org. We do hope you have enjoyed this podcast, and we encourage you to keep up to date with what's happening at Cell and the Cell Press family of journals by following our quarterly programs. I'm Keith Wallman. Thank you for listening.